she had read his thoughts. Just like home, Russell thought to himself. The house was made of stones instead of block, and the roof was flat instead of peaked, but the dust was the same, and the pathetic little garden was the same. And the man might as easily have been a Sioux. The tiredness in his eyes, the bent back, the old, gnarled hands of one defeated by others. This must be the place, he said as the truck slowed. The old man's son fought the Israelis and was badly wounded. Both have been friends to us.
You have to look out for your friends, Marvin agreed.
The truck stopped, and Russell had to hop out to allow Gone to step down.
Come along. I will introduce you.
It was all surprisingly formal to the American. He didn't understand a word, of course, but he didn't have to. The respect of his friend Gone for the old one was good to see. After a few more remarks, the farmer looked at Russell and bowed his head, which embarrassed the American. Marvin took his hand gently and shook it in the manner of his people, muttering something that Gone translated. Then the farmer led them into his garden.
Damn,
Russell observed when he saw it.
American Mark 84, 2,000-pound bomb, it would appear, Gone said offhandedly, then knew he was wrong.
The nose wasn't quite right. Of course, the nose was crushed and distorted, but oddly so. He thanked the farmer and waved him back to the truck.
First, we must uncover it. Carefully. Very carefully.
I can handle that, Russell said. He went back to the truck and selected a folding shovel of a military design.
We have people,
the American cut going off. Let me do it. I'll be careful.
Do not touch it. Use the shovel to dig around it, but use your hands to remove the soil from the bomb itself. Marvin, I warn you, this is very dangerous.
Better step back, then. Russell turned and grinned. He had to show this man that he was courageous. Killing the cop had been easy, no challenge at all. This was different.
And leave my comrade in danger? Gone asked rhetorically.
He knew that this was the intelligent thing to do, what he would have done had his own people done the digging, because his skills were too valuable to be risked stupidly, but he could not show weakness in front of the American, could he? Besides, he could watch and see if the man was as courageous as he seemed. Gone was not disappointed. Russell stripped to the waist and got on his knees to dig around the periphery of the bomb. He was even careful of the garden, far more so than Gone's men would have been. It took an hour until he'd dug a shallow pit around the device, piling up the soil in four neat mounds. Already Gone knew that there was something odd here. It was not a Mark 84. It had roughly the same size, but the shape was wrong, and the bomb case just wasn't right. The Mark 84 had a sturdy case made of cast steel, so that when the explosive filler detonated, the case would be transformed into a million razor-sharp fragments, the better to tear men to bits. But not this one. In two visible places, the case was broken, and it wasn't quite thick enough for that kind of bomb. So what the hell was it? Russell moved in closer and used his hands to pull the dirt off the surface of the bomb itself. He was careful and thorough. The American worked up a good sweat, but didn't slacken his efforts even once. The muscles in his arm rippled, and Gone admired him for that. The man had a physical power like none he had ever seen. Even Israeli paratroopers didn't look so formidable. He'd excavated 2 or 3 tons of dirt, yet he barely showed the effort, his movements as steady and powerful as a machine.
Stop for a minute, Gone said. I must get my tools.
Okay, Russell replied, sitting back and staring at the bomb. Gone returned with a rucksack and a canteen, which he handed to the American.
Thanks, man. It is a little warm here.
Russell drank half a liter of water. Now what? Gone took a paintbrush from the sack and began sweeping the last of the dirt from the weapon.
You should leave now, he warned.
That's okay, Ibrahim. I'll stay if you don't mind.
This is the dangerous part.
You stayed by me, man, Russell pointed out. As you wish. I am now looking for the fuse.
Not in the front? Russell pointed to the nose of the bomb.
Not there. There is usually one at the front. It appears to be missing. That's just a screw-on cap. One in the middle and one at the back.
How come it don't have no fins on it? Russell asked. Don't bombs have fins on them, you know, like an arrow?
The fins were probably stripped off when it hit the ground. That's often how we find such bombs, because the fins come off and lie on the surface.
Want me to uncover the back of the thing, then?
Very, very carefully, Marvin, please.
Okay, man.
Russell moved around his friend and resumed pulling the dirt off the back end of the bomb case. Gone, he noted, was one cool son of a bitch. Marvin was as scared as he had ever been, this close to a shitload of explosives, but he could not and damned well would not show anything that looked like fear to this guy. Ibrahim might be a little pencil-necked geek, but the dude had real balls, dicking with a bomb like this. He noted that Gone was sweeping the dirt off like he was using the brush on a girl's tits, and made his own efforts just as cautious. 10 minutes later, he had uncovered the back.
Ibrahim.
Yes, Marvin, Gone said without looking.
There ain't nothing here. The back's just a hole, man.
Gone lifted the brush from the case and turned to look. That was odd. But he had other things to do.
Thank you. You can stop now. I still have not found a fuse.
Russell backed off, sat on a mound of dirt, and proceeded to empty the rest of the canteen. On reflection, he walked over to the truck. The three men there, along with the farmer, were just standing. The farmer watching in the open, the others observing more circumspectly behind the stone walls of the house. Russell tossed one man the empty canteen and had a full one returned the same way. He gave a thumbs-up sign to all of them and walked back to the bomb.
Back off for a minute and have a drink, Marvin said on his return.
Good idea, Gone agreed, sitting his brush down next to the bomb.
Find anything?
A plug connection. Nothing else.
That was odd, too, Gone thought, pulling the top off the canteen. There were no stenciled markings, just a silver and red label block near the nose. Color codes were common on bombs, but he'd never seen that one before. So what was this damned thing? Maybe a FAE or some kind of submunition canister? Something old and obsolete that he'd never seen before. It had come down in 1973, after all. Maybe something that had long since gone out of service. That was very bad news. If it were something he'd never seen before, it might have a fusing system that he didn't know. His manual for dealing with such things was Russian in origin, though printed in Arabic. Gone had long since committed it to memory, but there was no description for anything like this. And that was truly frightening. Gone took a long pull from the canteen, and then poured a little across his face.
Take it easy, man, Russell said, noticing the man's tension. This job is never easy, my friend, and it is always very frightening.
You look pretty cool, Ibrahim.
It wasn't a lie. While brushing the dirt off, he looked like a doctor, almost, doing something real hard, Russell thought, but doing it. The little fucker had balls, Marvin told himself again. Gone turned and grinned.
That is all a lie. I am quite terrified. I truly hate doing this.
You got a big pair, boy, and that's no shit.
Thank you. Now I must return while I still can.
You really should leave, you know.
Russell spat into the dirt.
Fuck it. That would be very difficult, Gone grinned. And if you got a reaction from her, you might not like it.
I guess when these suckers come, the earth really does move.
Gone knew enough of American idiom that he fell backwards and laughed uproariously.
Please, Marvin, do not say such things when I am working. I like this man, Gone told himself. We are too humorless a lot. I like this American. He had to wait another few minutes before he calmed down enough to resume his work. Another hour's brushing showed nothing. There were seams in the bomb case, even some sort of hatch. He'd never seen that before. But no fuse point. If there was one, it had to be underneath. Russell moved away some more dirt, allowing Gone to continue his search, but again, nothing. He decided to examine the back. "There's a flashlight in my sack."
"Got it."
Russell handed the light over. Gone lay down on the dirt and contorted himself to look into the hole. It was dark, of course, and he switched on the light. He saw electrical wiring and something else. Some sort of metal framework. Lattice work would be more accurate. He judged he could see perhaps 80 centimeters. And if this was a real bomb, there would not be so much empty space. So. Gone tossed the light to the American.
"We have just wasted 5 hours, he announced.
"Huh?
I don't know what this thing is, but it is not a bomb."
He sat up and had a brief attack of the shakes, but it didn't last long.
"What is it, then?" "Some kind of electronic sensing device, perhaps? A warning system? Maybe a camera pod? The lens assembly must be underneath. That doesn't matter. What is important is that it is no bomb."
"So now what?"
"We move it. Take it back with us. It might be valuable. Perhaps something we can sell to the Russians or the Syrians."
"So the old guy was worried about nothing?"
"Correct."
Gone rose and the two men walked back to the truck.
"It is safe now," he told the farmer.
Might as well tell him what he wanted to know, and why confuse him with the facts of the matter. The farmer kissed Gone's dirty hands and those of the American, which further embarrassed Russell. The driver pulled the truck around and backed into the garden, careful to do as little damage to the rows of vegetables as possible. Russell watched as two men filled a half-dozen sandbags and hoisted them onto the truck. Next, they put a sling around the bomb and began to crank it up with a winch. The bomb, or whatever it was heavier than expected, and Russell took over the hand winch, displaying his strength yet again as he cranked it up alone. The Arab swung the A-frame forward, then he lowered the bomb into the nest made of sandbags. A few ropes secured it in place, and that was that. The farmer would not let them leave. He brought out tea and bread, insisting on feeding the men before they left, and Gone accepted the man's hospitality with appropriate humility. 4 lambs were added to the truck's load before they left.
"That was a good thing you did, man,"
Russell observed as they pulled off.
"Perhaps," Gone said tiredly.
Stress was so much more tiring than actual labor, though the Americans seemed to handle both quite well. 2 hours later, they were back in the Baca Valley. The bomb, Gone didn't know what else to call it, was dropped unceremoniously in front of his workshop, and the party of 5 went to feast on fresh lamb. To Gone's surprise, the American had never had lamb before, and so was properly introduced to the traditional Arab delicacy.
"Got something interesting, Bill," Murray announced as he came into the director's office.
"What's that, Danny?"
Shaw looked up from his appointment schedule. "A cop got himself killed over in Athens, and they think it was an American who did it."
Murray filled Shaw in on the technical details. "Broke his neck barehanded?" Bill asked.
"That's right. The cop was a skinny little guy," Murray said. "But,
Jesus. Okay, let's see."
Murray handed the photo over.
"We know this guy, Dan. It's not the best picture in the world."
"Al Denton thinks it might be Marvin Russell. He's playing computer games on the original slide. There were no prints or other forensic stuff. The car was registered to a third party who disappeared, probably never existed in the first place. The driver of the other vehicle is an unknown. Anyway, it fits Russell's description, short and powerful, and the cheekbones and coloration make him look like an Indian. Clothing is definitely American. So's the suitcase."
So you think he skipped the country after we got his brother? Smart move, Shaw judged. He was supposed to be the bright one, wasn't he? Smart enough to get teamed up with an Arab. Think so? Shaw examined the other face. Could be Greek, or anything Mediterranean. Skin's a little fair for an Arab. But it's a pretty ordinary face, and you said it's an unknown. Gut call, Dan?
Yep.
Murray nodded. I checked the file. A confidential informant told us a few years ago that Marvin made a trip east a few years back and made contacts with the PFLP. Athens is a convenient place to renew the association. Neutral ground. Also a good place to make connections for a drug deal, Shaw suggested. What current info do we have on Brother Marvin?
Not much. Our best CI out there is back in the joint. Had a brawl with a couple of reservation cops and came off second best.
Shaw grunted. The problem with confidential informants, of course, was that most of them were criminals who did illegal things and regularly ended up in jail. That both established their bona fides and made them temporarily useless. Such were the rules of the game. Okay, the FBI director said. You want to do something. What is it? With a little nudge, we can spring the CI on good time rules and get him back into the Warrior Society. If this is a terrorist connection, we better start running some leads down. Ditto if it's for drugs. Interpol has already come up blank on the driver. No record of his face for either terrorist or drug connections. The Greeks have come to a blank wall. Information on the car didn't lead them anywhere. They have a dead sergeant, and all they got to go on is two faces with no names attached. Sending the photo to us was their last shot. They figured him for an American. Hotel? The director asked, ever the investigator. Yeah, they identified that. That is, they know it's one of two places side by side. There were 10 people with American passports who checked out that day, but they're both little places with lots of in and out, and they came up with nothing useful for identification purposes. The hotel staff is forgetful, that kind of a place. Who's to say that our friend even stayed there? The Greeks want us to do follow-up on the names from the hotel register, Murray concluded. Bill Shaw handed the photo back. That's simple enough. Run with it. Already being done. Assuming we know that these two had anything to do with the killing. Well, you gotta go with your best guess. Okay, let the U.S. attorney know that our CI has paid his debt to society. It's about time we ran those warriors down once and for all. Shaw had won his spurs on counterterrorism, and that class of criminal was still his first hate. Yeah, I'll play up the drug connection on that. We ought to have him sprung in 2 weeks or so. Fair enough, Dan. When's the president get into Rome? Murray asked. Pretty soon. Really something, isn't it?
Bet your ass, man. Kenny'd better find himself another line of work soon. Peace is breaking out.
Shaw grinned. Who would have thunk it? We can always get him a badge and a gun, so's he can earn an honest living. Presidential security was completed with a discreetly located flight of 4 Navy Tomcat fighters that had followed the VC-25A at a distance of 5 miles, while a radar surveillance aircraft made sure that nothing was approaching Air Force One. Normal commercial traffic was set aside, and the environs of the military airfield being used for the arrival had not so much been combed as strained. Already waiting on the pavement was the president's armored limousine, which had been flown in a few hours earlier by an Air Force C-141B, and enough Italian soldiers and police to discourage a regiment of terrorists. President Fowler emerged from his private washroom shaved and scrubbed pink, his tie exquisitely knotted, and smiling as brightly as Pete and Daga had ever seen. As well he might, Connor thought. The agent did not moralize as deeply as D'Agostino did. The president was a man, and as most presidents were, a lonely man. Doubly so with the loss of his wife. Elliot might be an arrogant bitch, but she was undeniably attractive,
And if that's what it took to allay the stress and pressure of the job, then that's what it took. The president had to relax, else the job would burn him up, as it had burned others up, and that was bad for the country. So long as Hawk didn't break any major laws, Connor and D'Agostino would protect both his privacy and his pleasures. Pete understood. Daga merely wished that he had better taste. E.E. had left the quarters a little earlier and was dressed in something especially nice. She joined the president in the dining area just before landing for coffee and donuts. There was no denying that she was attractive, especially this morning. Maybe, Special Agent Helen D'Agostino thought, she was a good lay. Certainly she and the president were the best rested people on the flight. The media pukes. The Secret Service had an institutional dislike for reporters, had squirmed and fidgeted in their seats throughout the flight, and looked rumpled despite their upbeat expressions. The most harried of all was the president's speechwriter, who'd worked through the night without pause, except for coffee and head calls, and finally delivered the speech to Arnie Van Dam a bare 20 minutes before touchdown. Fowler had run through it over breakfast, and loved it. "Callie, this is just wonderful." The president beamed at the weary staff member, who had the literary elegance of a poet. Fowler amazed everyone in sight by giving the young lady, she was still on the sunny side of 30, a hug that left tears in Callie Weston's eyes. "Get yourself some rest and enjoy Rome."
"A pleasure, Mr. President."
The aircraft came to a stop at the appointed place. The mobile stairs came immediately into place. A section of red carpet was rolled in place to lead from the stairs to the longer carpet that led in turn to the podium. The President and Prime Minister of Italy moved to their appointed places, along with the U.S. Ambassador and the usual hangers-on, including some exhausted protocol officers who'd had to plan this ceremony literally on the fly. The door of the aircraft was opened by an Air Force sergeant. Secret Service agents looked outside suspiciously for any sign of trouble and caught glances from other agents of the advance team. When the president appeared, the Italian Air Force band played its arrival fanfare, different from the traditional American ruffles and flourishes. The president made his way down the steps alone, walking from reality to immortality, he reflected. Reporters noticed that his stride was bouncy and relaxed, and envied him the comfortable quarters where he could sleep in regal solitude. Sleep was the only sure cure for jet lag, and clearly the president had enjoyed a restful flight. The Brooks Brothers suit was newly pressed. Air Force One has all manner of amenities. His shoes positively sparkled, and his grooming was perfection itself. Fowler made his way to the U.S. ambassador and his wife, who conducted him to the Italian president. The band struck up the Star-Spangled Banner. Next came the traditional review of the assembled troops and a brief arrival speech that only hinted at the eloquence that would soon follow. In all, it took 20 minutes before Fowler got into his car, along with the ambassador, Dr. Elliot, and his personal bodyguards. "First one of those I've ever enjoyed," was Fowler's evaluation of the ceremony. There was general agreement that the Italians had handled it with elegance.
"Elizabeth, I want you to stay close. There are a few aspects to the agreement that we need to go over. I need to see Brent, too. How's he doing?" Fowler asked the ambassador.
"Tired, but pretty happy with himself," Ambassador Coates replied. "The last negotiation session lasted over 20 hours.
"What's the local press saying?" E.E. asked.
"They're euphoric. They all are. This is a great day for the whole world."
"It's happening on my turf, and I'll be there to see it," Jed Coates said to himself. "Not often you get to see history made."
Well, that was nice. The National Military Command Center, NMCC, is located in the D-ring of the Pentagon near the river entrance. One of the few such installations in government which actually looks like its Hollywood renditions, it is an arena roughly the size and proportions of a basketball court and 2 stories in height. NMCC is, in essence, the central telephone switchboard for the United States military. It is not the only one. The nearest alternate is at Fort Ritchie in the Maryland Hills,
since it is far too easy to destroy, but it is the most conveniently located of its type. It's a regular stop for VIPs who want to see the sexier parts of the Pentagon, much to the annoyance of the staff, for whom it's merely the place where they work. Adjoining the NMCC is a smaller room in which one can see a set of IBM PC-AT personal computers, old ones with 5.25-inch floppy drives that constitute the hotline, the direct communications link between the American and Soviet presidents. The NMCC node for the link was not the only one, but it was the primary downlink. That fact was not widely known in America, but it had been purposefully made known to the Soviets. Some form of direct communications between the two countries would be necessary even during an ongoing nuclear war, and letting the Soviets know that the only readily usable downlink was here might serve, some experts had judged 3 decades earlier, as a life insurance policy for the area. That, Captain James Roselli, USN, thought, was just so much theoretician-generated horseshit. That no one had ever seriously questioned it was another example of all the horseshit that lay and stank within Washington in general, and the Pentagon in particular. With all the nonsense that took place within the confines of Interstate 495, the Washington Beltway, it was just one more bit of data accepted as gospel, despite the fact that it didn't make a whole lot of sense. To Rosie Roselli, Washington, D.C. was about 300 square miles surrounded by reality. He wondered if the laws of physics even applied inside the Beltway. He'd long since given up on the laws of logic. Joint duty, Rosie grunted to himself. The most recent effort of Congress to reform the military, something it was singularly unable to do for itself, he groused, had prescribed that uniformed officers who aspired to flag rank, and which of them didn't, had to spend some of their time in close association with peers from the other uniformed services. Roselli had never been told how hanging around with a field artilleryman might make him a better submarine driver, but then no one else had evidently wondered about that. It was simply accepted as an article of faith that cross-pollination was good for something, and so the best and brightest officers were taken away from their professional specialties and dropped into things which they knew not the first thing about. Not that they'd ever learn how to do their new jobs, of course, but they might learn just enough to be dangerous, plus losing currency in what they were supposed to do. That was Congress's idea of military reform. "Coffee, Captain?" an Army corporal asked. "Better make it decaf," Rosie replied. "If my disposition gets any worse, I might start hurting people." Work here was career-enhancing. Roselli knew that, and he also knew that being here was partly his fault. He'd majored in sub and minored in spook throughout his career. He'd already had a tour at the Navy's intelligence headquarters at Suitland, Maryland, near Andrews Air Force Base. At least this was a better commute. He'd gotten official housing at Bowling Air Force Base, and the trip to the Pentagon was a relatively simple hop across I-295-395 to his reserved parking place, another perk that came with duty in the NMCC, and one worth shedding blood for. Once duty here had been relatively exciting. He remembered when the Soviets had splashed the Korean Airlines 747 and other incidents, and it must have been wonderfully chaotic during the Iraq War. That is, when the senior watch officer wasn't answering endless calls of what's happening to anyone who'd managed to get the direct line number. But now? Now, as he had just watched on his desk TV, the president was about to defuse the world's biggest remaining diplomatic bomb, and soon Roselli's work would mostly involve taking calls about collisions at sea, or crashed airplanes, or some dumbass soldier who'd gotten himself run over by a tank. Such things were serious, but not matters of great professional interest. So, here he was. His paperwork was finished. That was something Jim Roselli was good at. He'd learned how to shuffle papers in the Navy, and here he had a superb staff to help him with it. And the rest of the day was mainly involved with sitting and waiting for something to happen. The problem was that Roselli was a doer, not a waiter, and who wanted a disaster to happen anyway? "Gonna be a quiet day." This was Roselli's XO, an Air Force F-15 pilot,
Lieutenant Colonel Richard Barnes.
I think you're right, Rocky.
Just what I wanted to hear. Roselli checked his watch. It was a 12-hour shift, with 5 hours left to go.
Hell, it's getting to be a pretty quiet world.
Ain't it the truth? Barnes turned back to the display screen.
Well, I got my 2 MiGs over the Persian Gulf. At least it hasn't been a complete waste of time.
Roselli stood and decided to walk around. The duty watch officers thought this was to look at what they were doing, to make sure they were doing something. One senior civilian ostentatiously continued doing the post crossword. It was his lunch break, and he preferred eating here to the mostly empty cafeterias. Here he could watch TV. Roselli next wandered over to the left into the hotline room, and he was lucky for a change. A message was announced by the dinging of a little bell. The actual message received looked like random garbage, but the encryption machine changed that into clear text Russian, which a Marine translated.
So you think you know the real meaning of fear? Yeah, you think you do know, but I doubt it. When you sit in a shelter with bombs falling all over, and the houses around you are burning like torches, I agree that you experience horror and fright, for such moments are dreadful, for as long as they last. But the all-clear sounds, then it's okay. You take a deep breath, the stress has passed by. But real fear is a stone deep down in your chest. You hear me? A stone. That's what it is. No more.
Ilya Silvinsky, the Marine lieutenant said.
Hmm? Ilya Silvinsky, Russian poet, did some famous work during the Second World War.
I know this one. Sprach, the title is. Fear.
It's very good. The young officer grinned. My opposite number is pretty literate.
So, transmission received. The rest of the poem is even better, Alexei, the lieutenant typed. Stand by for reply.
What do you send back? Roselli asked.
Today, maybe a little Emily Dickinson. She was a morbid bitch, always talking about death and stuff. No, better yet, Edgar Allan Poe. They really like him over there. Which one?
The lieutenant opened a desk drawer and pulled out a volume.
Don't you do it in advance? Roselli asked. The Marine grinned up at his boss.
No, sir, that's cheating. We used to do it that way, but we changed things about 2 years ago when things lightened up. Now it's sort of a game. He picks a poem and I have to respond with a corresponding passage from an American poet.
It helps pass the time, Captain. Good for language skills on both sides. Translating poetry is a bitch. Good exercise.
The Soviet side transmitted its messages in Russian, and the Americans in English, necessitating skilled translators at both ends.
Much real business on the line.
Captain, I've never seen much more than test messages. Oh, when we have the sextate flying over, sometimes we check weather data. We even chatted a little about hockey when their national team came over to play with the NHL guys last August. But mainly it's duller than dirt. And that's why we trade poetry passages. Weren't for that, we'd all go nuts. Shame we can't talk like on CB or something. But the rules are the rules.
Guess so. They say anything about the treaty stuff in Rome?
Not a word. We don't do that, sir.
I see.
Roselli watched the lieutenant pick a stanza from Annabel Lee. He was surprised. Rosie had expected something from the Raven.
Nevermore.
The arrival day was one of rest and ceremony and mystery. The treaty terms had still not been leaked, and news agencies, knowing that something historic had happened, were frantic to discover exactly what it was. To no avail. The chiefs of state of Israel, Saudi Arabia, Switzerland, the Soviet Union, the United States of America, and their host, Italy, arrayed themselves around a massive 15th-century table,
punctuated with their chief diplomats and representatives of the Vatican and the Eastern Orthodox Church. In deference to the Saudis, toasts were offered in water or orange juice, which was the only discordant note of the evening. Soviet President Andrei Ilyich Narmanov was particularly effusive. His country's participation in the treaty was a matter of great importance, and the inclusion of the Russian Orthodox Church on the Commission for Christian Shrines would have major political import in Moscow. The dinner lasted 3 hours, after which the guests departed in view of the cameras on the far side of the avenue, and once more the newsies were thunderstruck by the fellowship. A jovial Fowler and Narmanov traveled together to the former's hotel and availed themselves for only the second time of the opportunity to discuss matters of bilateral interest. "You have fallen behind in your deactivation of your missile forces," Fowler observed after pleasantries were dispensed with. He eased the blow by handing over a glass of wine.
"Thank you, Mr. President. As we told your people last week, our disposal facility has proven inadequate. We can't dismantle the damned things fast enough, and our nature lovers in Parliament are objecting to our method of neutralizing the propellant stocks."
Fowler smiled in sympathy.
"I know the problem, Mr. President."
The environmental movement had taken off in the Soviet Union the previous spring, with the Russian Parliament passing a new set of laws modeled on, but much tougher than, American statutes. The amazing part was that the Central Soviet government was abiding by the laws, but Fowler couldn't say that. The environmental nightmare inflicted on that country by more than 70 years of Marxism would take a generation of tough laws to fix.
"Will this affect the deadline for fulfilling the treaty requirements?"
"You have my word, Robert," Narmanov said solemnly. "The missiles will be destroyed by 1st March, even if I must blow them up myself."
"That is good enough for me, Andrei."
The reduction treaty, a carryover from the previous administration, mandated a 50% reduction in intercontinental launchers by the coming spring. All of America's Minuteman II missiles had been tagged for destruction, and the U.S. side of the treaty obligations was fully on track. As had been done under the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty, the surplus missiles were dismantled to their component stages, which were either crushed or otherwise destroyed before witnesses. The news had covered the first few destructions, then grown tired of it. The missile silos, also under inspection, were stripped of their electronic equipment and, in the case of American structures, 15 had already been declared surplus and sold. In 4 cases, farmers had purchased them and converted them to real silos. A Japanese conglomerate that had large holdings in North Dakota had further purchased a command bunker and made it into a wine cellar for the hunting lodge its executives used each fall. American inspectors on the Soviet side reported that the Russians were trying mightily, but that the plant built for dismantlement of the Russian missiles had been poorly designed, as a result of which the Soviets were 30% behind schedule. Fully 100 missiles were sitting on trailers outside the plant, the silos they'd left already destroyed by explosives. Though the Soviets had in each case removed and burned the guidance package in front of American inspectors, there were lingering intelligence evaluations that it was all a sham. The Erector trailers, some argued, could elevate and fire the missiles. Suspicion of the Soviets was too hard a habit to break for some in the U.S. intelligence community, as was doubtless true of the Russians as well, Fowler thought.
"This treaty is a major step forward, Robert," Narmanov said after a sip from his wine glass.
Now that they were alone, they could relax like gentlemen, the Russian thought with a sly grin.
"You and your people are to be congratulated."
"Your help was crucial to its success, Andrei," Fowler replied graciously.
It was a lie, but a politic one, which both men understood. In fact, it was not a lie, but neither man knew that.
"One less trouble spot for us to worry about. How blind we were."
"That is true, my friend, but it is behind us.
How are your people dealing with Germany?"
"The army is not happy, as you might imagine."
"Neither is mine."
Fowler interrupted gently with his pronouncement.
Soldiers are like dogs. Useful, of course, but they must know who the master is. Like dogs, they can be forgetful and must be reminded from time to time. Narmanov nodded thoughtfully as the translation came across. It was amazing how arrogant this man was. Just what his intelligence briefings had told him, the Soviet president noted. And patronizing, too. Well, the American had the luxury of a firm political system, Andrei Ilyich told himself. It allowed Fowler to be so sure of himself, while he, Narmanov, had to struggle every day with a system not yet set in stone. Or even wood, the Russian thought bleakly. What a luxury indeed to be able to look on soldiers as dogs to be cowed. Didn't he know that dogs also had teeth? So strange the Americans were. Throughout communist rule in the Soviet Union, they had fretted about the political muscle of the Red Army, when in fact it had none at all after Stalin's elimination of Tukhachevsky. But now they discounted all such stories while the dissolution of the iron hand of Marxism-Leninism was allowing soldiers to think in ways that would have ended in execution only a few years earlier. Well, this was no time to disabuse the American of his illusions, was it? Tell me, Robert, this treaty idea, where exactly did it come from? Narmanov asked. He knew the truth and wanted to see Fowler's abilities as a liar. Many places, as with all such ideas, the president replied lightly. The moving force was Charles Alden. Poor bastard. When the Israelis had that terrible incident, he activated his plan immediately and... Well, it worked, didn't it? The Russian nodded again and made his mental notes. Fowler lied with skill, evading the substance of the question to give a truthful but evasive answer. Khrushchev was right, as he'd already known. Politicians all the world over are not terribly different. It was something to remember about Fowler. He didn't like sharing credit, and was not above lying in the face of a peer, even over something so small as this. Narmanov was vaguely disappointed. Not that he'd expected anything else, but Fowler could have shown grace and humanity. He'd stood to lose nothing by it, after all. Instead, he was as petty as any local party apparatchik. Tell me, Robert, Narmanov asked behind a poker face that would have stood him well in Las Vegas. What sort of man are you? It is late, my friend, Narmanov observed. Tomorrow afternoon, then. Fowler stood. Tomorrow afternoon, Andrei. Bob Fowler escorted the Russian to the door and saw him off, then returned to his suite of rooms. Once there, he pulled the handwritten checklist out of his pocket to make sure he'd asked all the questions. Well? Well, the missile problem, he says, is exactly what our inspectors said it is. That ought to satisfy the guys at DIA. A grimace. It wouldn't. I think he's worried about his military. Dr. Elliott sat down. Anything else? The president poured her a glass of wine, then sat beside his national security advisor. The normal pleasantries. He's a very busy, very worried man. We knew that, didn't we? Liz swirled the wine around the glass and sniffed at it. She didn't like Italian wines, but this one wasn't bad. I've been thinking, Robert. Yes, Elizabeth? What happened to Charlie? We need to do something. It isn't fair that he should have disappeared like that. He's the guy who put this treaty on track, isn't he? Well, yes, Fowler agreed, sipping at his own replenished glass. You're right, Elizabeth. It really was his effort. I think we should let that out. Quietly, of course. At the very least. Yes, he should be remembered for something other than a pregnant grad student. That's very gracious of you, Elizabeth. Fowler tapped his glass against hers. You handle the media people. You're releasing the treaty details tomorrow before lunch?
That's right. About 9, I think.
Then after you're finished,
take a few of the journalists aside and give it to them on background. Maybe Charlie will rest a little easier.
No problem, Mr. President,
Liz agreed. Exercising that particular demon came easily enough, didn't it? Was there anything she could not talk him into?
Big day tomorrow.
The biggest, Bob. The biggest.
Elliot leaned back and loosened the scarf from her throat. I never thought I'd ever have a moment like this.
I did, Fowler observed with a twinkle in his eye. There came a momentary pang of conscience. He'd expected to have it with someone else. But that was fate, wasn't it? Fate. The world was so strange. But he had no control over that, did he? And fate had decreed that he would be here at the moment in question with Elizabeth. It wasn't his doing, was it? Therefore, he decided, there was no guilt, was there? How could there be guilt? He was making the world into a better, safer, more peaceful place. How could guilt attach to that?
Elliot closed her eyes as the president's hand caressed her offered neck. Never in her wildest dreams had she expected a moment like this. The entire floor of the hotel was reserved for the president's party, and the two floors under it. Italian and American guards stood at all the entrances and at various places in the buildings along the street. But the corridor outside the president's suite of rooms was the exclusive domain of the presidential protective detail. Connor and D'Agostino made their own final check before retiring for the evening. A full squad of 10 agents were in view, and another 10 were behind various closed doors. 3 of the visible agents had fag bags, black satchels across their chests. Officially called fast-action gun bags, each contained an Uzi submachine gun, which could be extracted and fired in about a second and a half. Anyone who got this far would find a warm reception.
I see Hawk and Harpy are discussing affairs of state, Daga observed quietly.
Helen, I didn't think you were so much of a prude, Pete Connor replied with a sly grin.
None of my business. But in the old days, people outside the door had to be eunuchs or something.
Keep talking like that and Santa will drop coal in your stocking.
I'd settle for that new automatic the FBI adopted, Daga said with a chuckle. They're like teenagers. It's unseemly.
Daga,
I know. He's the boss, and he's a big boy, and we have to look the other way.
Relax, Pete. You think I'm going to blab to a reporter?
She opened the door to the fire stairs and saw 3 agents, 2 of whom had their fag bags at the ready.
And I was about to offer you a drink, too, Connor said, deadpan.
It was a joke. He and Daga were non-drinkers while on duty, and they were nearly always on duty. It wasn't that he had never thought about getting into her pants. He was divorced, as was she, but it would never have worked, and that was that. She knew it, too, and grinned at him.
I could use one. The stuff they have here is what I was raised on. What a crummy job this is.
A final look down the corridor. Everybody's in place, Pete. I think we can call it a night.
You really like the 10mm?
Fired one last week up at Greenbelt. Got a possible with my first string. It doesn't get much better than that, lover.
Connor stopped dead in his tracks and laughed.
Christ, Daga. People might notice.
D'Agostino batted her eyes at him.
See what I mean, Pete?
God. Whoever heard of a guinea Puritan?
Helen D'Agostino elbowed the senior agent in the ribs and made her way to the elevator. Pete was right. She was turning into a damned prude, and she'd never ever been like that. A passionate woman whose single attempt at marriage had collapsed because one household wasn't large enough for 2 assertive egos. At least not 2 Italian ones. She knew she was allowing her prejudices to color her judgment. That was not a healthy thing, even over something both trivial and divorced from her job. What Hawk did on his own time was his business. But the look in his eyes. He was infatuated with the bitch. Daga wondered if any president had allowed that to happen.
Probably, she admitted. They were only men, after all, and all men sometimes thought from the testicles instead of the brain. That the president should become a lackey of such a shallow woman as this, that was what offended her. But that, she admitted to herself, was both odd and inconsistent. After all, women didn't come much more liberated than she was. So why, she asked herself, was it bothering her? It had been too long a day for that. She needed sleep, and knew that she'd only get 5 or 6 hours before she was on duty again. Damn these overseas trips.
So what is it? Kati asked just after dawn. He'd been away the previous day, meeting some other guerrilla leaders, and also for a trip to the doctor, Gon knew, though he could not ask about that.
Not sure, the engineer replied. I'd guess a jamming pot, something like that.
That's useful, the commander said at once. Despite the rapprochement, or whatever the key phrase was, between east and west, business was still business. The Russians still had a military, and that military still had weapons. Countermeasures against those weapons were items of interest. Israeli equipment was particularly prized, since the Americans copied it. Even old equipment showed how the Israeli engineers thought through problems and could provide useful clues to newer systems.
Yes, we should be able to sell it to our Russian friends.
How did the American work out? Kati asked next.
Quite well. I do like him, Ismail. I understand him better now.
The engineer explained why. Kati nodded.
What should we do with him, then?
Gon shrugged.
Weapons training, perhaps. Let's see if he fits in with the men.
Very well. I'll send him out this morning to see how well he knows combat skills. And you? How soon will you pick the thing apart?
I planned to do it today.
Excellent. Do not let me stop you.
How are you feeling, Commander?
Kati frowned. He felt terrible, but he was telling himself that part of that was the possibility of some sort of treaty with the Israelis. Could it be real? Could it be possible? History said no, but there had been so many changes. Some sort of agreement between the Zionists and the Saudis. Well, after the Iraq business, what could he expect? The Americans had played their role, and now they were presenting some kind of bill. Disappointing, but hardly unexpected, and whatever the Americans were up to would divert attention away from the latest Israeli atrocity. That people calling themselves Arabs had been so womanly as to meekly accept fire and death. Kati shook his head. You didn't fight that way. So the Americans would do something or other to neutralize the political impact of the Israeli massacre, and the Saudis were playing along like the lapdogs they were. Whatever was in the offing, it could hardly affect the Palestinian struggle. He should soon be feeling better. Kati told himself.
It is of no account. Let me know when you've determined exactly what it is.
Gon took his dismissal and left. He was worried about his commander. The man was ill. He knew that much from his brother-in-law, but exactly how sick he didn't know. In any case, he had work to do. The workshop was a disreputable-looking structure of plain wood walls and a roof of corrugated steel. Had it looked more sturdy, some Israeli F-16 pilot might have destroyed it years before. The bomb, he still thought of it by that name, lay on the dirt floor. An A-frame like that used for auto or truck service stood over it, with a chain for moving the bomb if necessary. But yesterday two men had set it up in accordance with his instructions. Gon turned on the lights. He liked a brightly lit work area, and contemplated the bomb.
Why do I keep calling it that? He asked himself.
Gon shook his head. The obvious place to begin was the access door. It would not be easy. Impact with the ground had telescoped the bomb case, doubtless damaging the internal hinges. but he had all the time he wanted. Doan selected a screwdriver from his toolbox and went to work.
President Fowler slept late. He was still fatigued from the flight, and he almost laughed at himself in the mirror. Good Lord, 3 times in less than 24 hours. Wasn't it? He tried to do the arithmetic in his head, but the effort defeated him before his morning coffee. In any case, 3 times in relatively short succession. He hadn't done that in quite a long time, but he'd also gotten his rest. His body was composed and relaxed after the morning shower, and the razor plowed through the cream on his face, revealing a man with younger, leaner features that matched the twinkle in his eyes. 3 minutes later, he selected a striped tie to go with a white shirt and gray suit. Not somber, but serious was the prescription for the day. He'd let the churchmen dazzle the cameras with their red silk. His speech would be all the more impressive if delivered by a well-turned-out businessman-slash-politician, which was his political image, despite the fact that he'd never in his life run a private business of any sort. A serious man, Bob Fowler, with a common touch, to be sure, but a serious man whom one could trust to do the right thing. Well, I will sure as hell prove that today, the President of the United States told himself in yet another mirror as he checked his tie. His head turned at the knock on the door. Come in.
Good morning, Mr. President, said Special Agent Connor.
How are you today, Pete? Fowler asked, turning back to the mirror. The knot wasn't quite right, and he started afresh.
Fine, thank you, sir. It's a mighty nice day outside.
You people never get enough rest. Never get to see the sights, either. That's my fault, isn't it? There, Fowler thought. That's perfect.
It's okay, Mr. President. We're all volunteers. What do you want for breakfast, sir?
Good morning, Mr. President.
Dr. Elliot came in behind Connor.
This is the day.
Bob Fowler turned with a smile. It sure as hell is.
Join me for breakfast, Elizabeth.
Love to. I have the morning brief. It's a nice short one for a change.
Pete, breakfast for 2. A big one. I'm hungry.
Just coffee for me, Liz said to the servant.
Connor caught the tone of her voice, but did not react beyond nodding before he left.
Bob, you look wonderful.
So do you, Elizabeth.
And so she did, in her most expensive suit, which was also serious-looking, but just feminine enough. She took her seat and did the briefing.
CIA says the Japanese are up to something, she said as she concluded.
What?
They caught a whiff, Ryan says, of something in the next round of trade negotiations. The Prime Minister is quoted as saying something unkind.
What, exactly?
This is the last time we'll be cut out of our proper role on the world stage, and I'll make them pay for this, Dr. Elliot quoted. Ryan thinks it's important.
What do you think?
I think Ryan's being paranoid again.
He's been cut out of this end of the treaty works, and he's trying to remind us how important he is. Marcus agrees with my assessment, but forwarded the report out of a fit of objectivity, Liz concluded with heavy irony.
Cabot is something of a disappointment, isn't he? Fowler observed as he looked over the briefing notes.
He doesn't seem very effective at telling his people who the boss is. He's being captured by the bureaucracy over there, especially Ryan.
You really don't like him, do you? The president noted.
He's arrogant. He's...
Elizabeth, he has a very impressive record. I don't much care for him either as a person, but as an intelligence officer, he has done a lot of things very, very well.
He's a throwback. He's James Bond, or thinks he is.
Fine, Elliot admitted. He's done some important things, but that sort of thing is history.
We need someone now with a broader view.
Congress won't go for it, the president said as breakfast was wheeled in. The food had been scanned for radioactives, checked for electronic devices, and sniffed for explosives, which, the president thought, put one hell of a strain on the dogs, who probably liked sausage as well as he did.
We'll serve ourselves, thanks. The president dismissed the Navy steward before going on. They love him there. Congress loves the guy. He didn't have to add the fact that Ryan, as deputy director of Central Intelligence, was not merely a president.